You will be witness to what I have discovered. May you be the jury. But your verdict will be one of self-conviction. I know what I have witnessed. Now it is your turn. Prepare yourself for a journey into a world where each new step may give you a better understanding of your own reality. Reality.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the fifth episode of Evolver, the podcast. In this episode, we got a great episode for you guys. We're interviewing Graham Hancock, the number one bestseller of Fingerprints of the Gods. He has written 9 factual-based, experience-based books, and we're interviewing about Entangled, his first fiction novel. And then after that, we've got Aaron Shaw from Evolver LA interviewing Daniel Pinchbeck. And they had a great discussion about some of Daniel Pinchbeck's ideas and talked a little bit about Daniel's new book that's coming out. And then we interviewed Robin Gunkel from Evolver Baltimore. I just want to apologize, everybody, for the wait from between podcasts. A lot of amazing things have happened to me since that last podcast, one of which is my daughter was born, Sage Monroe Hopkins. And I would just like to thank you guys for listening again. Sorry about the wait, and welcome you all back. And another thing I want to mention is that one of my favorite musical influences, a really, really intelligent, inspiring guy, Michael Larson, who went by the name Idea, actually passed away on October 16th. And his lyrics were just incredibly innovative and eye-opening and inspirational. And so I actually, all the music that's going to be in the podcast tonight is going to be some of Idea's songs. And I just ask everybody to really kind of sit down and try and just listen to the words that he has to say, because he's really just got some amazing things to say and amazing things, ideas and perspectives on life. So, rest in peace, Michael Larson, and I hope you guys all enjoy the show.
I got a little story I want to tell you. It was September 1st, 1999, the day of my death. My back was on the cold concrete as I took my last breath. And I saw my body laying on the ground as my soul hovered above it. Damn, Idea, he was a good-looking cat. But anyway, another day at 18 years of age, stepping to heaven's gates, anxious to see what God's got to say. Maybe he'll give me a gift for always saying my prayer. But he might send me downstairs for last year's love affair. Well, who cares? You know, right now it's all a mystery. I mean, I'll find out when I get there. Until then, I can't let it get to me. I'm keeping my cool. Besides, everybody dies, I'll just follow the white light like they do in the movies. It seemed like hours went by and I'm still traveling right towards the brightness. Now this ain't heaven or hell, this realm is lifeless. And I hate to say it, but this wild goose chase had me bored. No directions, no clues, and no idea what I was in for. But then forward I kept floating, and in a quick flash the light split directly in half and created a forked path. Representing each side was an angel. Now what's the task I have to untangle to meet the big man in charge, I asked. And the one to the right of me said, one of us always lies and one always tells the truth. Ask the right one the right question and he'll direct you to heaven. But if you ask the wrong one, son, farewell, you're going straight to well. Y'all get the picture. And the one on my left told me not to listen to his fibs. He said it ain't that complicated to find out where God lives. He told me to follow his path and tell God he said hi. Then the one on my right jumped in and told me not to believe his lies. And I'm like, Jesus fucking Christ. I didn't care much for life, but I'd have tried to stay alive forever if I knew this is what death was like. I was never good at problem solving, especially in emergencies. I get a tad bit nervous when concerned with burning for eternity. But anyways, I asked them which one lied, and they pointed at each other. And thinking I had it, I asked them the name of my mother. One said he don't know, the other said he know, but he can't tell me. God
damn, this is gonna be hard. And so I asked like 30 questions and I still wasn't sure. Then being me, I got pissed and gave them pricks a few good words. Frustrated with it all, I turned my back to the angels. And when I walked away, to my surprise, I found myself in heaven. You know what I'm saying? Kinda just turned around from the whole situation, rejecting everything that was going on. That's how I walked into heaven.
Hi, this is Chris Hopkins from Evolver, here today with Graham Hancock, who has written 9 novels previously. Some you may have heard of, The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, Supernatural, and most recently Entangled. So how are you doing today, Graham?
I'm doing good. And just to correct you, the previous books aren't novels. They're all nonfiction books. Books about investigations of historical mysteries, and Entangled, The Eater of Souls, is my first novel, and it's a fantasy adventure, time slip, sci-fi novel.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I used the wrong word there.
Not to worry. It's kind of important for me because I've made a very big transition.
Yeah.
From decades of writing, you know, very very detailed, thoroughly documented nonfiction, exploring extraordinary ideas, to moving into exploring extraordinary ideas through the medium of fiction.
Yeah. Well, I guess my first question is an easy transition from that. And what was it that inspired you to go this route of writing a fiction book as opposed to the previous, like, heavy volumes of nonfiction you've written?
Yeah, it was partly a feeling that I had taken the investigation of the possibility of a lost civilization, which was the main focus of my nonfiction work, as far as I could possibly take it, and a feeling that my writing in nonfiction had been slowed down by constantly having to bulletproof my arguments against the attacks of academic critics who are invested in a particular view of history, that I had begun to write defensively, and I felt that I wanted to get back to a place where I was free and uncontrolled by the reactions of others, and I began to feel that fiction would be a very interesting vehicle in which to explore extraordinary ideas. But there was a much more specific inspiration for Entangled, and this was in a series of visions that I had in Brazil under the influence of the powerful psychedelic brew called ayahuasca, the vine of souls, which has been in use by shamans in the Amazon for thousands of years as a vehicle to enter the spirit world and to interact with spirit beings. Now, I know that many mainstream scientists would ridicule such notions that there could be any such thing as a spirit world or non-physical intelligences that wish to communicate with humanity. But any scientist who feels that way, I would urge them to go and have 5 sessions of ayahuasca first and then review their opinions. Because it's very easy to dismiss such notions from an empirical materialist scientific framework, but once you have these experiences, it becomes much harder to dismiss them. Ayahuasca is really quite an extraordinary thing, and it's. The fundamental proposition of shamanism is that it opens a secret doorway inside our minds and allows us to project our consciousness through into other levels of reality that are not normally accessible to our senses. And that's why ayahuasca is so highly valued in the Amazon as a vehicle for entering the spirit world. And more and more modern scientific research is beginning to raise the possibility that there may be something to this, actually.
Yeah, definitely. I'm actually in the middle of Supernatural right now, where you've talked about that. I guess one thing you brought up is there has been a lot of criticism of your work from the scientific community, even though I think it's really well thought out and displayed in a good argument. And I was wondering, if there's what kind of reaction, if any, you've received on this book from the kind of academic scientific community?
Well, very little, you see, because this is the great joy of writing fiction, if people do get worked up about it, you can just say, well, you know, relax, guys, this is just fantasy. It provides us with a license to explore extraordinary areas of human experience. Without having to defend that with, 2,000 footnotes and a book that weighs, 5 or 6 pounds and is 800 pages long. That's the great beauty of writing fiction. It's been a tremendous liberation for me that I just don't have to armor plate my arguments anymore. That I can simply explore mysterious aspects of human experience and fundamental dilemmas. I mean, ultimately, Entangled is a story about the battle of good against evil. This in my view has been a fundamental part of the human story for a very, very long while, and I don't believe that good and evil are social constructs, that there is no such thing as absolute good and absolute evil. I think that these are fundamental forces in the universe, as fundamental as gravity or electricity, and the particular predicament of the human creature is that we, through our consciousness, have the ability always, at every moment in our lives, with every choice we make, to choose between good and evil. And I would say that our lives are defined by the sum total of the choices that we make between those two poles.
Yeah. It definitely did a good job of exploring that good versus evil and making it hard to make an argument for one side not being evil.
Yeah.
So you said that this book was specifically inspired by a handful of visions that you had.
Which showed me very, very strongly, the central elements of this story, that it would bind together the remote past and the present. That there would be two central characters, two young women, Rhea, living in the Stone Age 24,000 years ago in the time of the last Neanderthals. She herself is an anatomically modern human like you and I, but she's living at a time when the last Neanderthals are also on the planet. And the other main character, Leonie, is a troubled young woman living in Los Angeles in the 21st century. And these two young women are brought together by a supernatural being, an angel, to do battle with a demon who travels through time, who's seeking to manifest fully in the 21st century, and who will do that, who will gain the psychic charge necessary to do that, by misleading humanity in the Stone Age into wiping out a kind of ethnic genocide of the last Neanderthals. And so the task and the mission for my two young women characters living at opposite ends of history is to join forces to prevent this massacre taking place, that however the Neanderthals become extinct, they must not become extinct because human beings have wiped them out. That's the fundamental element of the Entangled story.
Yeah. I know I've always been a big fan of Philip K. Dick, and I read once that his last novel was the only one that had a main character that was a female, and he said that that was hard for him to do, being a male. And I was wondering if that was something that you grappled with as well, writing the perspective of two main characters that were females.
No, for me it was very clear from the beginning and from the visionary experiences I had in Brazil that my central characters were going to be female, and I had no difficulty in writing that at all. It's a curious thing. I've spoken of the ayahuasca brew. Ayahuasca is a mixture of two different plants. One of those plants is a bush, the leaves of a bush. The botanical name for that bush is Cicotria viridis. It's called chacruna in the Amazon. And its leaves contain dimethyltryptamine, DMT, powerful Schedule I drug. And the other ingredient of the brew is the ayahuasca vine itself. And when the two are mixed together, you get a brew in which DMT, which is not normally orally active, becomes orally active. There's an enzyme in our stomachs called monoamine oxidase that switches off DMT on contact. And so if you were to make a tea out of those leaves alone and drink it, it would have no effect on you whatsoever. But in the vine, the second ingredient of the brew, it turns out that there's a monoamine oxidase inhibitor which switches off the monoamine oxidase in the stomach and allows the DMT to be absorbed orally. Now, interestingly, in the Amazon, shamans believe that a great intelligence lies behind this brew, and they associate that intelligence with the ayahuasca vine. And they always invariably see that intelligence as female, as feminine, that this is a great female spirit who sometimes takes the form of a human woman and sometimes takes the form of a serpent. And her essence is love for the human race, although sometimes this can be tough love. And I think that this divine feminine aspect of ayahuasca is one of the reasons why my two principal characters are strong but troubled young women. And part of the story is their own grappling with the dark side in their own characters. In a sense, they have to overcome that before they can overcome the darkness of the demonic force.
Mm-hmm.
I had no difficulty in writing female characters. I found it perfectly straightforward thing to do.
All right. I guess, like, I definitely noticed at the end, to my surprise, that there will be a second book. And I was wondering how much of a timeline should we expect on that? Or maybe do you have a little idea what it would be about? Or,
well, I'm already 100 pages into the second volume of Entangled. Like I say, I mean, this is an unusual process for me. I in writing this book, look, it's an adventure story. It's mm-hmm. driven by action. There is just constant action and movement in this story. And when evil is presented, it is presented in its full darkness. But it's a story that just keeps on moving.
Yeah.
What I found was it was too big a story to write in one volume. I would have ended up with another 1,000-page book. It was a story that had to be broken into two volumes. And just as every chapter ends on a cliffhanger, the whole novel ends on a cliffhanger with the modern character Leone plunged into the underworld, from which I can assure you she will be rescued in the second volume by the Stone Age character Rhea. And what brings these two young women together, how they're able to make contact across time, is by means of altered states of consciousness. In the case of Leone, the modern character, its experiences with DMT, and later in the Amazon with ayahuasca that enable her to make contact with the Stone Age character. And in the case of Rhea, the Stone Age character, its experience with psilocybin mushrooms, which she's taught how to use by the Neanderthals, that enable her to leave the confines of her body and travel freely through time and space. And the book goes into all kinds of mysteries like near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, and I think gives a very different model of the whole nature of consciousness. This is one of the things that I really wanted to explore in this book, but to do so in a fictional setting, that consciousness is a great mystery, and that it is possible for consciousness to exist outside of the body. That's why the book really begins with a near-death experience when the modern character takes a drug overdose of OxyContin and actually dies and flatlines in the emergency room. But while flatlining, has a series of extraordinary experiences and an encounter with the angel who sets her on her mission to do battle with the demon. And what underlies all of this is the notion that consciousness may not, in fact, be, generated by the brain in the way that a factory makes cars, but that consciousness might be received by the brain, that the brain might be a receiver of consciousness rather than a generator of consciousness, and that if that is the case, then by altering our state of consciousness, we're altering the receiver wavelength of the brain and gaining access to a much wider and previously unseen reality, which nevertheless surrounds us at all times and in all places.
Yeah. I know that a lot of this novel seemed like it was very influenced by your studies and knowledge of kind of primitive man. And I was wondering what were some of your like kind of main influences on the way that you depicted the tribes, the clans, and also the Neanderthals.
Well, while I was researching my last nonfiction book, Supernatural, I learned a lot about the Stone Age and about human communities in the Stone Age. But interestingly, at the same time, I also learned a lot about the Neanderthals. And the view when I was researching and writing Supernatural in the early 2000s through until 2005, the scientific view of the Neanderthals was very negative. They were considered to be, you know, stupid, clunky, knuckle-dragging, ape-like creatures with no symbolic abilities, no culture, no spirituality. It was held that Neanderthals and humans had not interbred in any way. Generally, there was a very negative picture of Neanderthals. But when I had my visionary experiences in Brazil with ayahuasca, I was shown a completely different picture of the Neanderthals. I was shown the Neanderthals as beings of pure love and goodness and light, beings who couldn't speak out loud but who communicated telepathically, who had enormous healing powers, who were non-violent and gentle spiritual creatures. This was the vision of the Neanderthals that I was shown. I was also shown that they had interbred with human beings, and that Neanderthals were compassionate and loving creatures. And one of the mysteries of this novel is that in the last month, long since I finished the novel has just been published in the U.S., long since I finished the novel, new information has begun to come out about the Neanderthals. For example, in Entangled, I depict the Neanderthals as having red hair. We now know that the Neanderthals did have red hair. The latest genetic studies have shown this. I depicted the possibility of Neanderthals and humans interbreeding. For a long time, science had totally rejected that. But now we've sequenced the genome of the Neanderthals. We know that Neanderthals and humans did interbreed, and that about 4% of modern human genes are owed to our contacts with the Neanderthals. Indeed, the gene for red hair in modern human populations is now understood to be Neanderthal gene.
Oh, wow.
And the notion that the Neanderthals were compassionate, which science had previously rejected, during the month of October 2010, there's been a huge amount of new evidence which shows that the Neanderthals were compassionate and caring creatures. For example, that they would look after their elderly or their infirm or their injured long after the point when they ceased to be naturally viable. But they would provide them with a loving and supportive community which enabled them to survive and to live. So in a sense, everything that I had to say about the Neanderthals in terms of science fiction has subsequently been validated as science fact. And,
wow.
And this just suggests to me, and there are many, many more reasons for saying this, that visionary experiences are important, fundamental part of the human birthright, and that our society is making a huge mistake in shutting us off from visionary experiences and in creating a climate of fear and suspicion around psychedelic substances, which actually have the potential to be tremendous instruments for spiritual and intellectual liberation.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that all that stuff came out since reading your book. Now that I've read your book, that's amazing. I know that I know the first four chapters of this are available to read right now for anybody on Reality Sandwich. And was that going to be it, or were you releasing more chapters on Reality Sandwich?
No, there's four chapters. They've been online on Reality Sandwich, and they're online on my own website, which is www.grahamhancock.com, so that people who are interested in the basic idea of the book can get a look at the writing and decide whether they want to go buy the book or not. And it seems to me that the first four chapters are enough for people to make up their minds on. On my website, I also have pages and pages of the scientific background to Entangled, including mysterious information about ayahuasca and DMT and alterations in consciousness. And we also have a video trailer about the novel. So there's quite a lot of information for people to make up their minds on there and see whether it's something for them or not.
Yeah. So I guess I wanted to ask you a question about Supernatural, which I'm getting to now, and it led to this book and the experiences. One thing I've definitely, through my own experiences of transformation and experience of different consciousness, my views on a lot of the things in the past have changed, and things I've thought about before and written before I've hoped that maybe I could rewrite or think about again. And I was wondering if maybe some of your views on your past books might be more complete now or changed to in a different direction now after going through the whole experience of Supernatural.
Oh, yes, very, very, very much so. I mean, again, the direct experiences that I have now had with altered states of consciousness, I mean, I initially drank ayahuasca. I first started to drink it in 2003 as part of the research for Supernatural. But since then, I've continued to work with ayahuasca every year as an important part of my own spiritual discipline and of my own direction in life. And these experiences with ayahuasca and with other psychedelics have indeed caused me to reevaluate some of my earlier work. For example, I did an enormous amount of work on ancient Egypt. It was the focus of many of my books. And I've realized now that it's impossible to understand ancient Egypt without taking altered states of consciousness into account. The ancient Egyptians were deeply interested in the mystery of life after death. You know, what happens to us when we die? Is it just all over? Does the light go out? Or does consciousness continue after death? This is a subject on which modern science is completely unable to comment. In fact, despite all its achievements, modern science is incompetent in this area. We're really midgets in the inquiry into the mystery of life and death, whereas the ancient Egyptians devoted their best minds for 3,000 years to considering precisely this mystery. And the conclusion they came to is that life does continue after death, that consciousness does not end when the body ends, and that we face a perilous and difficult journey after death in which we will be assessed for everything that we have done with the great gift of life that we are given. And ancient Egypt sought to prepare its initiates for this great adventure that occurs after death. And I now understand that that process of preparation by the shaman priests of ancient Egypt involved a deliberate induction of altered states of consciousness on their part, and that when they talk about the afterlife realm, they were speaking from real, direct, personal experience of that realm, not simply from theoretical constructs. It's why, for example, we find that all of the deities of ancient Egypt are depicted in what is called therianthropic form. A therianthrope is from the Greek therion, which means wild beast, and anthropos, which means man, is a combination of animal and human in its appearance. And if you think of the great Sphinx, combination of lion and human, if you think of the god Anubis, the psychopomp, the guide of souls, a combination of jackal and human. Every single one of the Horus, a combination of hawk and human, every single one of the Egyptian deities has this form. And it's now well understood, going back to the cave art of 30 or 40,000 years ago and coming right through to modern research with psychedelics and human volunteers, that entities, intelligent entities, encountered in deeply altered states of consciousness very often present themselves to us in this form that is part animal and part human. Why they do that, I don't know. But the fact that they do appear in that form appears to be completely universal across all human cultures and across all periods of history. So when we find a culture that is emphasizing those particular forms of its deities, we can be sure that the shaman priests of that culture were working with altered states of consciousness. And I think that that the use of psychedelics and the exploration of altered states of consciousness by ancient societies is one of the missing pieces in the puzzle of the study of our past. And it's missing because our scientists, historians, and archaeologists have no experience of those states of consciousness, no, and therefore don't believe that they're valid or important.
Yeah. Man, I could just keep asking a bunch of questions about that, but we're running out of time here. So I guess that you just went on a book tour through this country, and then you just did the dimensional shift retreat with Reality Sandwich. And
it was a wonderful experience.
Do you have any more events that you have coming up, or would you like to talk briefly about either one of those events? Or?
Well, I don't have any more events coming up in the United States this side of 2011, but I will certainly be back in the U.S. in 2011. The Dimensional Shift retreat at Boulder Mountain Guest Ranch in Utah. It's the second year that I've attended and presented information at that retreat, and I just think it's one of the great things that Reality Sandwich and Evolver are putting together, the opportunity for 60 or 70 like-minded people to gather in a beautiful natural environment, the canyon country of southern Utah, the amazing Native American rock art that we find on the canyon walls in that area, just the majesty and the grandeur of nature, to gather together and to share experiences and to explore the nature of reality. This is very important work. It's a kind of node point for a new form of thinking, which humanity desperately needs if we're going to get through this crisis of fear and hatred and suspicion that is being generated in the world today. I mean, everywhere I travel, I sense and pick up this miasma of fear and hatred and suspicion. And it's obvious that it's being deliberately generated by politicians and by business figures because it serves their interests. And it's being done with all the weapons of mind control and mass communication that are available in modern society. And we need some antidote to that. And what I find with Reality Sandwich and Evolver is that you are providing the setting and the gathering together of people who can provide an antidote to that particular state of mind, and who are willing to bring love back into the world. And love is what is desperately, desperately needed today.
Yeah. Well, I think that is a great note to leave this on, Graham. Thank you so much for doing the podcast, and I really enjoyed your book. And thank you.
That's my pleasure. I've enjoyed talking to you.
All right. Bye.
Okay. Keep well. Bye.
He lives in a 4x2 glass box. It reminds me of my head. I wish my floor would have rocks, but it's covered with puddles instead. If I could be him, life would be great. I could erase this permanent frown. I wouldn't even be held down by my own weight. I woke up, walked to the tank to hear his thoughts on yesterday. How was it, I asked? And after a tap on the glass, he looked my way, then gave me this depressed expression and pressed his best just to say, and besides the tides and the gray skies, it was okay. And I said, hey, Mr. Fish, you get all that you wish. You got nothing to complain about while hanging out in this bit. And he replied, well, existence is bliss. There's so much that you miss. Besides, get off the trip. Happiness is just a myth. I said, living in water is extremely more peaceful than life. You find it with mind blinded by the evil and forced to see through these two peoples. It seems to redeem freedom, not being limited by walls. But that only means I qualify as ground for the sky when it falls. That only means I qualify as ground for the sky when it falls. That only means I qualify as ground for the sky when it falls. That only means I qualify as ground for the sky when it falls. But Mr. Fish just laughed as I went on and on and on. So I interrupted his chuckle, putting up a middle finger. And he boldly told me, it's too bad I'm such a thinker. So arrogantly I asked, how could someone think too much? He added that insanity lingers and thoughts brought me to the brink of such. He said, you live inside a head that reminds me of my glass box. And everyone's the same, all brains are contained by your reality frame. And chained to the terrain, it's trained not to change. And once you see what I've explained, you hit the jackpot.
Yeah, and at that very moment, it was like my eyes really opened. The air that previously surrounded me was now an ocean, still totally invisible except for minor pieces of debris. The Mr. Fish pushed up to the glass and he looked just like me. My whole world spun around, I didn't understand, but I realized I was no longer a man. So I thought about what he said and asked him what was going on. And he said, you didn't know it, but you were the fish all along. He said, congratulations, you did it, you broke free. You're just a fish, like the rest of humanity. Now it took me a long time to get adjusted to this tank, but now I know what I am. And so to that man I give thanks. I've always lived inside this glass box, it reminds him of his head. It just goes to show you that your mind is your own monster. Reality's what you make it, and if you take it away, you're just a fish like me, swimming in the...
All right. Once again, that was Graham Hancock, and I just really had an amazing time talking to him, and I was really thankful for the opportunity to be able to interview him. And it just, it's really, his work is really well thought out, intelligent, and very thoughtful. And it, in a different way, it kind of reminds me of Buckminster Fuller's work, where a big thing that Buckminster Fuller always stressed was we had to decondition ourselves from the educational system that we've been that's been force-fed to us, and educate ourselves again based on our experiences and others' experiences, and try and take into account with open mind everything. And I think Graham does an amazing job of doing that and keeping that in mind. So next up, we have Robin Gunkel from Evolver Baltimore, and they've really been doing a lot of amazing things out there, like some of the most creative, innovative, inspirational spores that have happened across the network come out of Baltimore. And I can encourage you guys to check out on Evolver.net when their regional post spore questionnaires get posted, to check out what Baltimore's been doing, because it's awesome. And they also just launched an alternative currency called the B-Note, which is something that Evolver has had intentions of doing since the very beginning, and we're all very excited about this, and it's something for you guys to look forward to. All right, enjoy the interview. Thank you.
Hi, I'm here today with Robin Gunkel, who's the regional coordinator for Evolver Baltimore, and they got a lot of cool stuff going on out there, and I'm excited to be here with her today. We're going to talk a little bit about some of this. So how are you today, Robin?
I'm well. Thank you for having me on the show today, Chris.
Yeah. So a lot of the regional coordinators I've talked to, myself included, have kind of had this story of how it was that we actually got involved with Evolver. And I was wondering, what's your story about how you got involved with Evolver, and how, if maybe you could tell us a little bit about this?
Sure. It actually started with me working at a New Age bookstore here in Baltimore. And actually, I'd gone to Burning Man in 08, and I heard Daniel Pinchbeck speak. And then I mentioned to my boss, Susan Weiss at Breathe Books, that I'd heard Daniel speak, and it had left quite an impression on me. And Susan contacted him and asked him to come speak at the store. And as it turned out, they were planning their 2012 Perspectives on the Next Age book tour. So I guess it was in February of 2009, I got to meet Daniel, Jonathan Phillips, and Ken Jordan. And at the time, one of my friends, Michelle, was writing for Reality Sandwich, and they had asked him to become the coordinator for Evolver Baltimore. But Michelle ended up moving to Vietnam. And I was doing a lot of blogging on Evolver, and so Michelle asked me if I would like to be the coordinator.
Well, that's awesome. So one thing that I know everybody in the Evolver network is pretty excited about is Evolver Baltimore has just launched the B-Note, which is an alternative currency, and that's something that Evolver has been interested in from the beginning, and I've actually been really interested in looking and doing that in Sacramento as well. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the B-Note and how it started and just what's going on with it.
Okay. You know, the B-Note really began with one of our members, Michael Tu. And Michael has actually had the intention for a number of years of starting a regional currency. He was living in D.C., and he when he heard about Evolver Baltimore, he felt that Baltimore was the place where he needed to be living, and that this would be the place to launch the currency, and that Evolver would help him with doing so. And it did. Michael was really the initial catalyst for the B note. And then he got Jeff Dickin on board around the Energy Spore last year, last December. Jeff, you know, decided that he also wanted to work on this project. And we were holding meetings like every 2 weeks at Jeff's house for a number of months. And then in June, we decided to do our resilience spore as currency. And I think from that point on, it really got the ball rolling with the B note. It just continued to collect momentum from there. But that was really the launch was with our June spore in some sense.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, that also leads me to this next question. Is you guys have had some of the most like creative spores that across the network that I've noticed from reading the post-spore questionnaires. And I was wondering what goes into your guys' process to decide how to approach these spores and these just creative ideas that you guys have come up with?
Okay. Honestly, sometimes, you know, a lot of the ideas often kind of start with me, like throwing out an idea and seeing if, you know, the rest of the group, you know, feels that, you know, it's kind of an idea worth going in. But they collect their own gravity. So the Life in the Universe party that we threw in July, we had an art show, but we also installed the space. So we, you know, there was it was all a group effort, you know, one person, Mike Morstein, collecting, you know, like a huge, you know, load of sticks that, you know, Michael too then delivered to us at the whole gallery, and all of us spent the next number of days hanging every night, wiring them from water poles from the ceiling to really create a tree of life in this space that, you know, we had art hung within. Jonathan Phillips from New York came down to speak at our spore, you know, his kind of coming out of like the psychedelic closet experiences. And but it was a huge group effort that we worked together, you know, over, you know, a week to create. And, you know, that it starts as a, you know, sometimes an initial idea that I'll put out, but that everyone else helps realize that, you know, one person could never have done on their own. Mackenzie, another one of our members, was gifted with all of these like bones and, you know, snake skins, pinned butterflies that, you know, we used as part of the show. So it was everyone kind of pulling together their resources. We made a geodesic dome out of bamboo that we cut down from the farm that Jamie and Mackenzie live on, and, you know, figured out how to construct a geodesic dome, which involved a lot of duct tape. But it was, yeah, it was group projects that helped also strengthen us as a group that, you know, through the process of putting on, there was the event itself. But putting the event together strengthened us as a group and developed stronger bonds for us.
Yeah, I remember seeing pictures of that spore and reading about it, and I was super jealous. That sounded awesome. I guess kind of nearing the end here, can you share one of your favorite moments, one of the most magic moments that you've had in your time with Evolver Baltimore?
Yeah, I think... one of the most magic moments for me, well, actually two that I want to mention, at our magic spore, after, you know, discussing magic, around a bonfire for a number of hours and discussing magic, maybe in the traditional sense of how we think of magic in terms of spells, but also then broadening out that definition to the magic of planting a garden or the magic of going clean, that everyone really kind of opening their hearts to each other in that space for a number of hours. And then at the end of the night, we looked up and there was a lunar rainbow, a perfect halo around the moon. And we stood, you know, on our friend Tom's lawn, just like reeling. We couldn't believe it. It was complete validation for everything that we had talked about that night. And then really another magic moment with our last spore, our visionary culture spore, Sunday last week. And just the energy of the room was so high. I don't think any of us had quite experienced anything like that before. And it was all of us coming in with a real open heart and, you know, just a complete non-judgment space, greeting each other as family and, you know, connecting through our hearts and engaging with, you know, the issues of our day, and really kind of took us on a journey together. And I think that everyone who was there that night would tell you the same thing.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Well, I really want to thank you not only for being on the podcast today, but just for all the amazing things that you guys are bringing the Evolver Network out there in Evolver Baltimore, because you guys really are having some of the coolest things going on out there. And I can't wait till all the cities in Evolver Network get up to that kind of level and creativity. So thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate you having me on today.
Yeah. All right. Bye.
All right. Once again, that was Robin Gunkel from Evolver Baltimore. And I really enjoyed talking to her. And also, like I said, I'm just really inspired by the spores that Evolver Baltimore has been able to put together in the community that they're actually building there in Baltimore, involving so many people. So thank you for doing the show, Robin, and maybe we'll have you on again sometime down the line. Like I mentioned earlier, this interview coming up is Aaron Shaw, who's the co-sporganizer down in Evolver, LA, and she's interviewing Daniel Pinchbeck again about some of his ideas. They talked about a blog that he's been doing recently, along with just some of his ideas on what the times that we're in. And they talk a little bit about his book, Notes from the Edge Times. So I hope you guys enjoy the interview.
Take a deep breath. There's nothing to be afraid of. What you just did was fall to the depths of existence, the place your mind avoids away from by its own process of building models for understanding. This is not insanity. This is, in fact, the ultimate reality. The union you've achieved is only possible if thoughts no more. You never fall if you never fight. You found yourself falling to madness, so you dove. The best thing you ever did was let go. You found yourself falling to madness, so you dove. The best thing you ever did was let go. I found myself falling to madness, so I dove. The best thing I ever did was let go. I found myself falling to madness, so I dove. The best thing I ever did was let go.
Life is a play, and we're always acting out without ever seeing it from the writer's or audience's point of view. But we reach infinity now. Let it go. The writer, the actors, and the audience at the exact same time.
So here you are, and now you understand. You always were here, that's why you always ran. But you can only run away for so long before you catch up with yourself and become part of the song. I'd like to welcome you to the heaven you created. I tell the truth, this is the wisdom of the ancients. Holding on to something contradicts our being, so fly free,
fly free,
fly free,
fly free.
Maybe I had to go crazy to get where I am. I felt myself slipping away and I let myself fall. Gotta lose your mind before you find it. When you finally find it, you find out you never lost it at all. There's a natural flow that's attached to your soul. It don't ask you to go, it just gradually pulls. It's always now when you're never not you. So follow yourself, cause if nothing else, your existence is
have
true.
Have you ever felt yourself slipping away?
I am, I mean, I was slipping away. But no matter what I am, I'm me. And I know me, so I'm okay. Have you ever felt yourself slipping away? You are, I mean, you were slipping away. But no matter what you are, you're you. And you know you, so you're okay.
I'm not a poet or a communist, a comet or a star. You're not a genius or a prophet, you just are. I'm not insane cause I have no need for my sanity. It's just another chain that keeps me from reality. Reality is mine to play with and mold. The best thing I ever did was let go. So let go of the models, transcend the physical mind and peacefully become part of the whole. The walls came tumbling down, but this time it was for keeps. I've been running around
looking for my feet, now they're part of the ground. And make the ground complete, live in the now. And forever be at peace, live in the now. Don't stray away from the cycle. I'm one with the universe, one with the life flow. When you know that that which is below is above, the fear you once had will become love. Have you ever felt yourself slipping away? I am, I mean, I was slipping away. But no matter what I am, I'm me. And I know me, so I'm okay. Have you ever felt yourself slipping away? You are, I mean, you were slipping away. But no matter what you are, you're you. And you know you, so you're okay. It starts out with a question. How much of it is real? Now all is irrelevant outside of this ordeal. Don't worry about explaining it. There ain't no human language that can actually describe exactly how you feel. Now I see clear through external distractions. Piece by piece it comes together. So I laugh and I smile. In the beginning it was deranged, but I guess all things come to pass. After a while, if madness could have a picture face, how would it look? Like step one to becoming the contents of your own book. Right where you are right now is where you're gonna stay. And as long as you're always moving with yourself, you'll never slip away.
Hello and welcome to the Evolver podcast. My name is Erin Shaw. I'm a news writer for Reality Sandwich and regional co-coordinator for Evolver LA. I'm here today talking with the editorial director of Reality Sandwich and founder of the Evolver social movement, Daniel Pinchbeck. Hello, Daniel.
Hey, Erin. Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks so much for your time. So I know you've been traveling and touring in support of both your book, Notes from Edge Times, and the movie, 2012, Time for Change. I've really been enjoying your guest blog on Powell Books, where you pretty much get like in-depth and personal about your mission as an artist and your travels. And so I wanted to use that as kind of a jumping-off point for this interview, if that's cool. And
sure.
So, yeah, what first struck me about your Powell's blog is some of the metaphors for societal transformation. So I've read a lot about read a lot of metaphors for societal change. You know, like in the movie, we mentioned the mycelial network as a metaphor for communications, and then we talk about the Evolver network as a social organism. So I'm wondering if you can share, what is your favorite metaphor for transformation and why?
Well, one that seems to be gaining ground, you know, among a lot of people, including my friends, some of friends of mine in L.A. have a company there called Datrium, is the caterpillar to butterfly transition, where basically the caterpillar, you know, creates a cocoon, and then it's not like the caterpillar just, like, sprouts wings and flies off as a butterfly. The caterpillar kind of melts down into a biotic soup and consumes everything in its environment. And finally, as it's kind of dissolving, the handful of imaginal cells that contain the kind of program for the emergence of the butterfly begin to kind of transmit the signal. And at first, those cells are kind of recognized or are seen as kind of invaders by the immune system of the caterpillar, but then they propagate the signal further out, and ultimately they reorganize the entire biotic soup into becoming a butterfly. So it's pretty extraordinary. And if you think about that, you know, a concept that a lot of people in the sort of more of a New Age mystical world have used is a dimensional shift. And it is very interesting. You think about a caterpillar becoming a butterfly, because there's a literal gain in the dimension, you know, from being stuck to the earth to being able to float above it. Also from being a kind of consumer to a pollinating species. So, go ahead.
No, I love that metaphor because I think the, you know, cocoon to butterfly metaphor has been used a lot, but I really got that imaginal cells as being the sort of, I saw it as like a metaphor for Evolvers, being networks of people who propagate this information that's going to get us to this next phase. And, you know, like you said, it's not this sudden process where you sprout wings into another dimension. And while there's sort of like talk of quantum jumps. I just really like the idea that there's clusters of cells, or people, I guess, as the metaphor would have, out there spreading information that will get us to the next stage and literally, like you said, give us this extra dimension of travel or getting us to different places, literally new experiences.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But so in any case, also what struck me is in your notes from Edge Time's essay, The Age of Uncertainty, you wrote that you've adopted the personal mantra, I don't know, as sort of like a humorous response to being cast in the role of 2012 expert, like, you know, when you were flown to Jackson and you were kind of put into this media machine around the Roland Emmerich movie. So I wonder, can you tell me more about what it was like to find yourself in the very media machine that you critique in your books?
Well, yeah, it was fun, actually. I mean, I've gone through a whole process with the media. I used to write for New York Times Magazine and Esquire and Rolling Stone, and then I became, you know, a kind of subject for them. Rolling Stone did a very unflattering profile, and New York Times gave a very nasty review of 2012. And in a way, like, you know, ultimately, I mean, it hurt at the time, but then taking it personally, I began to see that was a sign that I was doing my job. That if the kind of mainstream system felt compelled to comment upon me on my work, but then also be kind of negative about it, it was like a sign that I was somehow getting under the skin of the system. And now the whole situation keeps changing and evolving. I feel that it's just part of my, you know, role as an imaginal soul, you know, hopefully it's almost like the machine is trying to figure out how to process this material, and it only has a very, very limited mechanisms for doing so. It can either, attack it, ridicule it, critique it, or celebrate it. You know, so we haven't really seen, I mean, with the whole Evolver movement, which I think is the most fascinating, you know, thing that I'm really involved with right now. I haven't really seen any article from an outside or mainstream source that has made any effort to understand, you know, what we're doing and why. And I'm curious to see how that will ever be examined. I'm almost thinking that we have to do something mildly outrageous so that they can find a way to comment upon it at least as ridicule. I was thinking that if we incorporated Evolver as a new religion and claimed that it was like a religious movement, then it would give them an avenue towards ridicule, which would at least create press. At the moment, I think it's too confusing for the media machinery to understand what we're doing. And in terms of also what I said, you know, in that art essay, but I don't know, but I do feel still that I'm in a kind of transitional phase in the development of my own thinking. And also, you know, I reserve the right to change my mind and to be flexible. Rather than to get caught in things that seemed, you know, but then don't come to pass, I think that we need to be able to, like, address our own mistakes, you know. So I'm still very intrigued about 2012 and beyond, and I feel, you know, I never said that anything particular was going to happen on that date exactly, and that it's more like the hinge point of a transformation or transmutation process. But I really, you know, still don't know whether we're looking at a, you know, 10, 20 years or even, you know, multi-generational process. You know, although if you look at the data around sea level rise, even the more conservative views say to three to six, feet rise in sea level by 2050, it's going to have a massive impact on human life on the planet. So it does seem as if, a radical transformation is underway and will only continue, and that there's the possibility for it to be shaped consciously rather than just being incoherent and chaotic and evolve into kind of despotisms.
Yeah. that brought to mind like two things that I think you've incorporated in your writing. I think it's either a Thoreau or a Ralph Waldo Emerson who said that foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. But foolish consistency seems to be kind of the mode of media. And so, you know, here you are presenting ideas about like nonviolent resistance at a time of, you know, perpetual war and ecological crisis. And it seems like you're getting a whole mix of responses across the board. But, you know, like you said, probably the Evolver Network is fulfilling its mission, even if the mainstream media doesn't know what to make of it. But, yes, that's really encouraging. But so also in your guest blog, this really piqued my interest. You wrote about how the information superhighway and the prevalence of social media is causing a shift in perception of self and other. You know, you've written before about like social media now kind of supporting this flattered self, and but ultimately it's bringing about like a new social landscape. So can you explain the link between social media and this shift in perception that you've written about?
Yeah, I mean, so I was just at a cafe with a friend of mine the other day. You know, we were sitting in the back room and everybody was on their computers, you know, in their own little bubble of you know, kind of closed awareness. And, you know, I was really thinking that if you look around, it really actually does feel kind of like an incubation period, you know, kind of like the caterpillars in their cocoons. You know, actually something had this very eerie and palpable tangibility in a way. That, you know, we're somehow learning, you know, how to connect with each other. You know, just a blink of geological time ago, you know, we were apes. You know, we were clubbing each other over the head for bananas. You know, suddenly we figured out language. Now we've developed all these, you know, media and communications technologies. And now we're figuring out, you know, what are we together? How do we collaborate? How do we go from competition to cooperation? And I feel like I forgot a little bit of your initial question.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was so cool, though, how you wrote about how this kind of inundation of info is kind of shaking up our ideas of authority. And there's just so much new stuff to get into at any given moment that our very selves are sort of becoming malleable. And I'd like to think this is part of this metamorphosis, too. So,
Definitely. I mean, you know, in terms of the, there's a, you know, definitely a lot of things are melting down right now, you know, including perhaps the you know, the media, you know, the media industries, the book publishing industry, you know, the traditional corporate structure, the financial structure. You know, it does very much seem like that, you know, we're creating a kind of, you know, biotic soup of all of our social constructs and institutions as they kind of melt down. And, yeah, on the individual level, you know, I think it's forcing us, you know, either people are becoming rigidified in, like, old belief systems and kind of, like, getting really boring really quickly, or people are being forced to become more flexible and more open and, you know, able to kind of sift between all sorts of different ideas and not be so beholden to one authority structure. And yeah, so I think that also, yeah, has an effect on individual self-identity. You know, we're not you know, if you read the letters of people in, like, the 19th century, you know, there, I mean, in a way, we've definitely lost something, too. I mean, there was a tremendous erudition and kind of a literary depth perception that you know, that even, you know, all sorts of people possess, which maybe we've temporarily forfeited a bit. You know, I think it's part of our sense of our identity shifting from being so isolated and kind of existential to more permeable and malleable and a greater awareness of how, you know, social media interaction is constantly shaping and reshaping what we perceive to be our own self.
Yeah. So how do you see Evolver either easing this shift in perception of self or, you know, we talked about before the melting down of authorities and people becoming more malleable. So how does Evolver help help to bring about coherence between thought and action? I don't know if that makes sense. But what
That's a good question. I think that is really the best way for that to happen is through community and transparency. And I don't think in terms of what Evolver offers as a platform yet, that's totally in place. I think that would be something we would continue to build in the future.
Right.
A great example of that for me is a system like Couchsurfing, where, you go sleep on somebody's couch, and then you say, the guy was pretty nice, but the couch was lumpy, and the guy says, I didn't like that, person so much because, they said they were going to do this, they didn't do that, you're forced into more and more ethically sound behavior by a transparent system. I think that's a really interesting idea, and I think in a way that people really fear transparency now because of the sense of privacy and encroachment by corporations and governments. But ultimately, I think in this kind of new planetary culture, transparency will become something that people will actually see as a value, because it'll bring about a higher level of ethical behavior on an individual and community level. So I think one of the key components of whatever new planetary culture may emerge would be an increasing coherence between thought and action, and that's also something that that's still in development. When I look at myself and many of the people that I know, I see those gaps, where people wanted to be a certain way or discuss being a certain way, and they're still not necessarily there in their own lives. But I think that the increasing feedback loops, the increasing knowledge, the processes of initiation and self-education a lot of people are going through are forcing the closing of those loops, so that people are more and more, like, if they want to, kind of participate in the evolutionary trajectory, they're almost going to be impelled into becoming more coherent. And I think that's a tough thing, but I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, I remember that being a thread among Evolver coordinators, is how do we get from, holding salons and building community to being kind of projects-oriented. And one of the keys to that is instilling a reputation system where it really matters, like on Couchsurfing, how you treat the people that you work with, and that kind of follows you, and you actually have a reputation that other people can refer to. And I also remember, too, in your writing on the Powell's blog, you wrote about how this sort of interiority and inner life was so valued by modern Western culture before. And now we're kind of seeing, like I mentioned before, this flattered self that, we put out our blips on Facebook, and it doesn't really constitute collaboration the way the social media networks could. And then I kind of see Evolver, maybe this is premature to mention, but I see Evolver as becoming more project-oriented and a little more active, I guess. I'll just use that word. And, of course, the key to that would be getting people who are really committed and, ready to make these sort of changes and ready for thought and action to cohere.
Go ahead. No, well, you're about to come into a question mode, so go ahead.
Oh, well, that kind of leads me to, I don't think this is really a jumping off point of the last question, but I'm really curious, and I wanted to ask it because I remember when we were hosting screenings of 2012 Time for Change here in Los Angeles, just about every night somebody would ask some variation of, like, how are you going to get this movie out to the public all the way to, you know, why don't you put the movie for free on the internet? And it kind of seems there's this expectation that entertainment is that you should pay for entertainment, but then you get, like, this truly valuable information should be out there for free, and that money should not be a barrier to people accessing the information that's, like, you know, in the movie 2012, Time for Change, that aims for transformation. But so how do you respond when someone asks you about, like, the distribution model or the promotion of the movie?
That's an interesting question, Aaron. I mean, I think what you just said is a really fascinating conundrum. Like, people, you know, if, you know, a Hollywood studio spends $100 million on a huge spectacle, and everybody, you know, kind of feels okay about supporting that. But with art film, and we had to, like, kill ourselves for 3 years to put this thing together. And so many people are like, oh, well, you should give it away for free. I mean, that's a great, you know, I mean, in a way I would love to, but then how do we make more media? Like, if we can't make a profit on this, you know, for the investors who put money into it, then we don't get to make another film like this. You know, so I feel like people need to, you know, think more in a whole systems way. You know, and obviously, you know, in the film we're discussing a shift in economic paradigm and our belief in the commons and so on. But you know, we also have to deal with the system that we're in now. You know, and that's why I've always really liked, you know, that the name of the company is Evolver, and why I kind of bought it back from my previous failed effort to do it, Evolver, is that we're in an evolutionary process, and you know, what we're kind of asking for people is to become more aware of the transition, and you know, and see things more in a whole systems way, you know, and sometimes be a little patient, you know. So yeah, our film is now going to be, by the time people hear this, it's going to be available on DVD, on the website 2012 Time for Change, and they can also host screenings. So I hope people, you know, who wanted to see it out, you know, see it out in the world, will, you know, buy a copy, show it to their friends, you know, host a screening. There are ways that they can have the filmmakers like me or Joao Skype in after the screening. You know, yeah, I mean, we're doing our best to get the word out, but we also need people to collaborate with us.
Yeah, that's so great. It reminded me of, you know, hosting Evolver. I just learned so many lessons the hard way about this, how it's like you can't just make this quantum jump. There's very much like you need to use these transitional systems, like even capitalism, which you've written about as the sort of transitional system, to get these kind of pretty much visionary ideas out there. And it's like it's a total conundrum to use the social media that we're so used to and all of that to get ideas out there about what social media and interaction could be. You know, there's when people are quick to point out any iota of hypocrisy in that, but really I've learned through Evolver that there's no hypocrisy, just kind of evolution.
I think that's really the case, and you know, go ahead. I think you're right. Once again, I cut you off as you were formulating a question, so I'll let you question away.
If you had something to say, I wanted to give you the time for sure, but I mean, there's no shortage of questions up my sleeve. But so, you know, in closing, I just want to mention we have a potentially large-scale collaborative project coming up that's going to be a really good laboratory for how to bring people together across the network. That kind of sprung from your idea from 2012, Time for Change, to make Dr. Ryan's water electrolysis motorcycle an open source manual. And I guess I'll just talk a little bit about this. So you interview Dr. Ryan Martina in the movie, and he built the water scooter. He's in there for a short little segment. But you two are friends, and I work for Ryan. And so we've kind of been brainstorming these ideas about putting together an open source manual to make the water electrolysis combustion engine, and then crowdsource groups of people to work on these things and actually implement these projects. And so I like to think that this is kind of a shift to being more project-oriented and active and very hands-on in thinking about energy systems and getting these alternative energy systems out there. And more importantly, getting just regular people to kind of realize that they can make energy systems themselves. But so can you tell me a little bit about where you got the idea to start this project and whatever you feel comfortable to share about it?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, first of all, I mean, you know, showing the film around, definitely Ryan's water scooter is something that a lot of people are, you know, really amazed by and have a lot of questions about. And a number of people have been like, you know, can you put me in touch with Ryan? You know, I want to learn how to make this thing. And just seeing that type of, you know, immediate response led me really realize that we should actually, we really need to have a website where this information is available for people if they want to, you know, go through the process. And then I found on the web a really cool website called windowfarm.org, which is a crowdsourcing website for people who want to grow some of their own food in their urban environment, small urban apartments. So they've created these kind of little window farms using recyclable components like plastic bottles and so on, little aquaponics grow kits. People will create videos or little manuals, and they'll trade information, and then in a way the website itself will cull the best projects, you know, using comments and so on. So I just realized that would be a perfect model for a kind of collaborative brain trust around these water engines. So yeah, for me it seemed like a perfect project for a kind of open source enterprise. And you know, that to me is something that's very interesting. This idea that open source is going to migrate from the computer, you know, from how people create software to how they create physical hardware and infrastructure. So I'm very excited to be involved with this project, and I'm happy that my little seed idea has, you know, seems to be moving into a sprout.
Yeah. Ryan talks a lot about, like, the evolution of the Internet from, you know, the communications layer up to, like, the energy systems layer where there's interconnected energy systems and all of that. And so that kind of brought to mind, like, thinking about the Internet as, like an Internet of projects. People linked in, well, where we are, you know, in L.A., also in New York and Boston, or anywhere there's some engineer or somebody with a little know-how or the bravery to learn making these systems and then telling their friends about it. And that's what's so great about having the Evolver Network in place, sort of a platform for collaboration on so many levels. It's the blog, and hopefully now as we move into our second year of Evolver, we become more projects-oriented. But,
Aaron, this is a little bit off topic. I've got to leave in a second, but I want to say that, you know, you should put down in an email to me your ideas around Evolver.net 2.0, because you're kind of reminding me of a bunch of stuff that, you know, I wanted to get in there. I'd love to hear, and in fact, you know, at some point we're going to have some kind of mini conferences around Evolver 2.0 and how it could be redesigned, but I would love it if you put your ideas down in an email and send them to me.
That would be so rad. I love tapping into these kind of conversations. So thanks so much for your time. I hope this has kind of spurred some thoughts for you. It certainly has for me. And I hope we can get our Evolver audience involved. I will be writing about the water electrolysis combustion engine, how you can find our open source manual, and more importantly, how you can get involved.
That's awesome. And I want to put a plug in for the film. I hope people will check it out. Also, my new book, Notes from the Edge Times.
Right.
You know, I think it's a short book, relatively speaking, compared to the last book. But I definitely think there's some ideas in there that, you know, buried in those essays that would be very, very exciting for people. And, you know, it's pretty easy reading, so I hope they'll jump in and check it out.
Yeah, I'd love to tease those ideas out with you some other time. But thanks so much for your time and contribution, Daniel. And I guess I'll be seeing you at Burning Man or sometime
before then, I'm sure. We'll figure it out.
Okay. Thanks, Daniel. Have a good day.
Have a great day, Aaron. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye.
All right. So that was our last interview for this show. I want to thank Aaron for doing the interview and Daniel for being on the show again and just for all the amazing work that Daniel's doing across the Evolver Network. It really, we're just lucky to have the Evolver HQ team that we do. I just can't see Evolver being possible without any of our Evolver HQ, and Daniel being a major role of that himself. And it's really awesome. They're doing a lot of great work. Another news we can mention for Evolver is the Ayahuasca Monologues. Fourth annual Ayahuasca Monologues just happened, so you can probably be looking out for some video from that coming up on Reality Sandwich soon. 2012 Time for a Change is actually available to purchase online now, which is kind of a big deal because previously it was only available at 2012 Time for a Change events. But the people that produced it are also still really helping to facilitate private screenings around the country, and if that's something you guys would like to do, you can get in touch with them. You can also, if you have a bigger screening, something of a larger scale, they've been Skyping in different people that were in the film, the director, or even Daniel Pinchbeck has been Skyped in for some interviews at screenings. So, I mean, if you guys are out there and you're willing to put some planning in it and you'd like to see the film, it really is an amazing opportunity to do this private screening of 2012 Time for a Change, which you can contact me and I'll put you in contact with the right people and you can talk to them and get more information about all this. And yeah, I just want to thank you guys for listening. Once again, I'm sorry it's been so long between episodes. I just really have had a whirlwind of a life lately, but it's been awesome. A lot of my goals and aspirations are starting to come true. Just opportunities I had at Greenfest and working down there in San Francisco, going to school, and that's been going really well for graphic design, and I love that. And just having a baby, and it's amazing every day to wake up to my daughter. She's massive, and other good news is my fiance, Virginia Jester, is actually coming to Alterati as well, which I want to thank Alterati for hosting our podcast again. I love being a part of the Alterati family, and now Virginia is joining it with the Empress Project podcast, which you guys can look out for. It'll be coming out in January 2nd. She really does an amazing podcast that's all about just kind of the spiritual path and awakening the Empress within us all. I've actually been on her podcast a couple of times, and, you know, it's an amazing podcast, and you guys should really keep your eyes open for that if you're listening to this. It'll be January 2nd, I believe. So I guess this will be about wrapping it up. Thank you all for listening to Evolver the Podcast. And, oh, one more thing. I definitely have to give a shout-out to the Evolver Social Movement, because once again, none of this would be possible without the Evolver Social Movement, and Evolver just keeps growing and growing and growing and growing and getting more ideas and doing more amazing things in the world. And really, I love the way Evolver's set up, because it's set up in this way where you can have as much participation as you want, or as little participation as you want, from just being informed on ideas and reading some articles and news to just full on like creating massive spores and having these big crazy parties. And even doing this podcast is because I got involved with Evolver, and there's just really a lot of opportunity to make a tangible impact and change in your community and the world through Evolver. As amazing as facilitating that, but none of that would even be facilitated or possible if it wasn't for the Evolver Social Movement. So I really want to thank you guys for this, and I can't wait to do the next podcast. I promise it'll be much sooner than 2 months from now. I hope you guys enjoyed the show, and thank you, Graham. Thank you, Robin. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Daniel. And look out for Entangled in Stores and Notes, Graham Hancock's first novel, and Notes from the Edge Times from Daniel Pinchbeck. It's his first actually fully written by him novel in a few years. So thank you, guys. Remember, it's our world to change, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
There is a way out of this passage. Just can't think your way out of it. Thought is your enemy. I know. I got to think less. I had a thought, actually.
You have to let go.
let go. Let go of what? Let go of you. Uh-huh. I mean, think about it. What have you done for you lately?
I'm having trouble following you, Johnson.
You have to jump in.
Jump in back on the scopes?
No, in the water.
River?
Yes, jump in the river, jump in the river, jump in the river.
To this river without knowing how to swim, and eventually we learn how to keep the water under our chins. Sometimes this river's so cold to be in, freezing my soul, solidifying my skin. Regardless of how far I see, I never see my travels in. We're carried by the current, being driven by the wind. The scenery we pass we'll never see again, so we store it up as memories and don't let go of them. We're under a spell, thinking that the river should go straight. We set goals and desire to control our own fate, but all the pain we experience is a result of our expectations, 'cause it's the river's nature to twist and turn. The shit can burn, and I know it. I have the same conflict, but I try to sit and flow with this river's natural process. Sometimes when I watch myself flow downstream, I see the beauty of it all, and it feels like a dream. And at that time, I appreciate the river's course. Some call it God, reality, momentum, force. I stare up at the naked moon as she stares down at me. Outside lost boundaries, I'm all I look outward to see. The universe is not something separate from yourself. I know you feel alone, but that's why I'm here to help. I know you feel alone, but just look up at the stars, and everything that is out there is what you really are. We gotta learn to see the beauty in each moment of life. Everyone has different paths, and we're seeking the light. The world is divided between peasants and kings, but the truth is everybody's looking for the same thing. Now I want you to know the role you play's part of the whole. Without you, it couldn't be, and I mean that with compassion. So if you ever need anything, I mean anything at all, I'm here for you. All you gotta do is ask, man. I'm here for you in the same way that you hear from me. Each person is an intricate piece of infinity. I feel like if you could see what I see, then we as humanity could be free. I'm here for you, not for any self-centered reasons, because existence is interdependent and all's related, connected as different manifestations of one single mind. You ain't isolated from the world, even though it feels like that sometimes. I see the hurt when I look into your eyes, how you struggle to hold it and keep it bundled inside. It tries to throw blade deep in my heart, it makes me wanna cry. So I offer you a hand to help you wash away the rainy skies. I'm running out of words, but I haven't yet made my message clear. So if none of this makes sense, I just want you to know I'm here as a musician, as a friend, as a teacher, as a student, to grow and realize that everything's in constant movement. Each problem that we face is just a part of this movement. It seems hopeless, but if we stick together, we'll get through it and return to the essence from which we've been uprooted, and wake humanity from these illusions. The second you can look into the sky and see your own reflection, you know you're headed in the right direction. The river ride ain't always smooth, but with it I live, and everything is perfect just the way it is. We gotta learn to see the beauty in each moment of life. Everyone has different paths, and we're seeking the light. The world is divided between peasants and kings, but the truth is everybody's looking for the same thing. Now I want you to know the role you play's part of the whole. Without you it couldn't be, and I mean that with compassion. So if you ever need anything, I mean anything at all, I'm here for you. All you gotta do is ask, man.
I'm here for you. All you gotta do is ask, man. I'm here for you. All you gotta do is ask, man. I'm here for you. All you gotta do is ask, man. I'm here for you. All you gotta do is ask, man. I'm here for you. All you gotta do is ask, man. All you got it, all you got it, man. I'm here for me. All you got it, all you got it, man. I'm here for me. All you got it, all you got it, man. I'm here for me. All you got it, all you got it, man. I'm here for me. All you got it, all you got it, man. I'm here for me. All you got it, all you got it, man. I'm here for me. All you got it, all you got it, man. I'm here for me. All you got it, all you got it, man.
Thank you. downstream. Everything is cool as I float downstream. Everything is cool as I float downstream. Everything